Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sally Becker.
And I'm Mark Dunlight. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with a live overview of the upcoming primary elections. Then, for our peace bucket, we get an update on Ukraine and nuclear weapons. After that, we talk with our Roman labor correspondent, Willie Terry, about his experience last weekend traveling to D.C. to cover the Poor People's March. Later on, Kathy Silber talks with Felicia Kuhn, president of the Cape Melanie chapter of the Coalition of Labor Union Women in the Capital District. Finally, we finish up with a segment from our archives with an interview with Megan Marone, who is still missing, about her involvement with Extinction Rebellion. But first, headlines.
Dennis Green, a longtime administrator with the Schenectady City School District, has been tapped to serve as the next Schenectady High School principal after spending the last 8 months in a role on the interim basis. A community care specialist and foster care worker for nearly a decade, Green came to the district in 2005 as a student counselor.
The Time Union reports that the use of a government center in Brunswick by Congressman Elaine Stefanik on May 31st for a meet and greet event appears to have violated the policy for the use of the taxpayer-supported venue. People suspected of being political opponents of the Schuylerville Republican were not allowed to enter the event, especially those protesting outside. The new congressional lines have shifted much of Rensselaer County into the North Country congressional districts. Congressmember Antonio Delgado, who until recently represented Brunswick, was previously denied use of the space for a similar event.
Supporters of Burnt Hills Boston Lake Parents' Rights School Board candidate Emily Walsh is pushing for her appointment to school board after a longtime school board member unexpectedly resigned after the election. Walsh received a third of the votes of the winning candidates. Many residents, however, have also written in their opposition to her appointment. The board will discuss the matter at its July 13th meeting.
A state Supreme Court judge has ruled that the state education department commissioner acted legally when she said that the Cambridge Central School District's Indian mascot must be replaced. The school board has spent much of a year studying whether to replace the mascot with an image that was unrelated to Indigenous people and eventually voted 3-2 to retire the Indian. However, 3 weeks later, after new board members were elected, the decision was reversed and the mascot restored. This decision was voided by the commissioner as being arbitrary and capricious.
Albany County's seven-day average of new daily positive cases is down to 53.7 from 54.7. The county's most recent seven-day average of COVID-19 cases per 100,000 individuals is down to 14.0, with an average percent positive rate of 7%. The Capital Region averages of cases per 100,000 is down to 14.4, with an average percent positive rate of 66.3%.
President Joe Biden on Wednesday called on Congress to suspend federal gasoline and diesel taxes of about 18 cents a gallon for 3 months and urged states to take similar action. Biden said high gas prices had increased opposition to climate action. Barack Obama, during the 2008 presidential campaign, called such an idea a gimmick that allowed politicians to say that they did something. He also warned that oil companies could offset the tax reliefs by increasing their prices. Progressive had called instead for a tax on excess profits or more government control over oil refining. Many analysts believe that the majority of the 8.6 inflation percentage seen over the past 12 months in the United States comes from higher commodity prices due to Russia's invasion of Ukraine and continued disruption from the coronavirus. That's it for the headlines.
Early voting has begun for next Tuesday's June 28th primary. Due to successful court challenges to the redrawing of election districts by state lawmakers following the new census, New York is holding primaries on two different dates. June 28th was the initial primary date, and statewide primary elections will continue as well as all others, such as the state assembly. The primaries for the House of Representatives and the state Senate are on August 23rd. Mark, can you tell us which offices people will be voting for in the current primary?
Well, for most people, they're really probably only voting in the Capital District for governor and lieutenant governor. And there are primaries in both major parties for both positions. Now, one interesting thing is in the primary, candidates for governor and lieutenant governor, you know, appear separately on the ballot. You can vote, you know, one person and then vote for somebody else different in the lieutenant governor race. Whereas after the primary, they run as a ticket in the general election. There are basically no primaries for state assembly in the Capital District, one exception being for Democrats in the Weston, Schenectady, and Montgomery County area, with incumbent Angelo Santa Barbara, being challenged by Justin Chairs. Primaries on election day are held at your normal voting place, wherever you normally vote, you know, in the general election. There are only a handful of early voting places in each county, such as the court-ordered polling site at the atrium in downtown Troy. If you want to find out where those early voting places are, contact your local board of elections for more information. Be aware that the hours vary by day at the different sites, so it's a little bit confusion. For general information about voting, you could start with the New York State Board of Elections. Their website is elections.ny.gov. Polls will be open on primary day and actually for the general election from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m.
So can you run us through the elections for governor and lieutenant governor?
I'm going to start with the Democrats. On the Democratic side, the race for lieutenant governor is considered more interesting because it seems right now pretty clear that Kathy Hochul is going to win the gubernatorial primary between Tom Suozzi and Jemani Williams. One of the complications is Antonio Delgado, who recently represented the Capital District, had resigned from Congress to be appointed lieutenant governor by Kathy Hochul following the resignation of Brian Benjamin, lieutenant governor, after his indictment for political corruption. Certainly, Delgado would still be considered a favorite because he was and is being backed by Hochul, and he has largely the support of the Democratic establishment, and he has a much bigger war chest for the campaign because he's able to move the money he had raised for his congressional seat into the lieutenant governor race. However, Anna Maria Archila, who's a longtime Latina community and gay rights activist from New York City, she co-founded the major immigrant rights group Make the Road. She also headed up the Center for Popular Democracy, a well-known, economic justice group. She's been campaigning very hard, and she has really a lot of support from the progressive community, including the Working Families Party. She is running, with Jemani. Jemani Williams himself ran a very close race for lieutenant governor 4 years ago against Hochul. He's not has been getting as much traction, and frankly, doesn't seem to be trying as hard this time around. However, Archila could make it a close race for lieutenant governor. The third candidate in the Democratic primary for lieutenant governor with a lot less visibility is Diana Rena, who is the run-in partner of Congress member Tom Suozzi. Suozzi has run a very aggressive campaign against Hochul, but has not been picking up much ground in the polls. The difference in the approaches in this lieutenant governor race is Delgado says, hey, I'm going to be a working partner with Hochul, and if I have disagreements, I'll be behind closed doors, whereas Archila basically is going to be a thorn in whoever is the governor's side, and will push for a lot more political debate and moving the Democratic Party to the left. And this race is really seen as a key test for the progressive wing of the Democrats in the state. On the Republican side is the governor's race that's getting all the attention. Congressmember Lee Zeldin down from Suffolk County has the backing of the party leadership and is considered the front runner. He is facing Westchester County executive and former GOP gubernatorial candidate Rob Astorino, as well as business person Harry Wilson, and somewhat of a wild card, Andrew Giuliani, who is the son of Rudy.
Are there any races to watch in the Capital District?
Well, as I mentioned, the only one really locally is the race for state assembly out in Schenectady, Montgomery counties, with Santa Barbara against Justin Shears. There had been expected to be a major Republican showdown for state Senate, with after redistricting, incumbent Stephanie Jordan was planning to face off against incumbent Schenectadian Jim Tedesco. Excuse me, after they end up after the same district. But Jordan recently dropped out, citing that the party basically was, you know, rallying behind Tedesco. She still remains on the ballot. In the general election, Michelle Osterlich, Schenectady County Legislature, will be the Democratic nominee. The most interesting locally is actually a little bit outside of the Capital District, down in the New Paltz area. And we're seeing the long-term liberal incumbent Kevin Cahill facing a very stiff challenge from climate activist and DSA member Shana Srestha, who's a first-generation immigrant from Nepal. She has a ton of support on the left, including active promotion by Congressman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And her race is seen as critical both for the climate movement overall and particularly the effort to expand DSA outside of New York City. Probably the most interesting races in the Capital District will be in the fall, particularly in the Senate District, which now includes much of Rensselaer County, with present Republican Assemblymember Jake Ashby facing off against social worker and former Democratic County Executive candidate Andrea Smith. I should note in the August primary, I believe Paul Tonko, who kind of was gerrymandered out of his district, but is running basically in the Capital District, will face for the first time a primary and a Democrat, but he is expected to win and then face off and probably defeat again Republican conservative Liz Joy. The other interesting race in the fall, which will be very critical nationally as to who control the House of Representatives after the midterm, is the race to replace Delgado, which is considered a swing district. Sort of an interesting sideshow is actually going to be a separate election with two county executives facing off in a special election to fill the remaining months of Delgado's existing term. But in the general term, the county executive from Ulster is moving south in that district. And so moderate Republican Mark Molinaro from Dutchess, who was the recent gubernatorial candidate for the GOP, who'll run against the winner of a three-way Democratic primary in August with Osen Zotik, Josh Riley, and Jamie Chaney.
Thank you for that, Mark. Remember, early voting has started. You can check with your county board of elections to determine locations and times, which vary daily. Polls will be open everywhere on Tuesday, June 28th from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. For our peace segment, Mark talks with Joe Gerson, the president of the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security. Gerson is the Vienna for the first meeting related to the non-proliferation treaty for nuclear weapons. He also discusses Ukraine.
For our peace bucket, we're joined by Joe Gerson, who is the president of the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security. And he's actually joining us from Vienna, where he's there for, I guess, some opening days of some meetings around the nuclear weapons, let's end them issue. But I was also responding to an article that he circulated, not one he normally would do, as he pointed out, from a former CIA analyst, Graham Fuller, who takes a pretty tough road, I guess, on what the United States has done and actually not accomplished with the Ukraine. Joe, do you want to sort of maybe sum up the key points of that article and why you decided to circulate it?
Sure. You know, I think in the United States, you know, we've been living with the illusion that somehow the Ukrainian government is going to defeat Russia in Eastern Europe, and you know that it's going to be cakewalk for democracy. But the reality is, as grim as it is, that Ukraine is not going to win in Eastern Ukraine. That the Russians are fighting a war of attrition with greater military resources. The costs for the Ukrainian people and for that area are tremendous. And we need to begin thinking about how this war can end, maybe with what Thomas Friedman called a dirty deal. But you know the perfect should not be the enemy of the good. You know, the reality is that divisions are emerging in Europe. NATO will not be as unified as has been promised. The impacts of the reduction of oil and gas from Russia means a very cold winter in much of Europe. We're dealing with inflation, not only in the United States, but in Europe as well. I think the Democrats have made a mistake in just the $40 billion just most recently sent, the unresolved commitment to a proxy war. And I am concerned what this means for the 2022 and 2024 elections, because it's the extreme right in the United States, people who are anything but Democratic, who have been raising questions about this war. And unfortunately, I think they're right.
You know, one of the, the universal combination of Russia for actually launching the investigation, I think is pretty well justified. You don't invade other countries advance political, disagreements.
Right.
But even Pope Francis has, pointed out that, the United States and their leadership of NATO, certainly played a major role in provoking, Russia to do the invasion. But one of the things that Fuller mentions in the article, which I have also raised, is just that the media really has just once again been in lockstep for promoting the war and really not given us a very perhaps nuanced picture as to what is taking place. And the media always seems, or at least truth, always seems to be one of the first casualty of war.
Yeah, well, that's basically, that is a truism in its own right. I've been on the road now for 2 weeks, but as I was leaving, the New York Times was beginning to break ranks by facing reality. The truth of the matter, and it's pretty well recognized here in Europe, is that the expansion of NATO to Russia's borders in violation of all kinds of common security agreements in the 1990s and pledges actually made to Gorbachev created a situation of security vulnerability on the part of Russia. I mean, Russia has suffered invasions, great invasions, three times in the past from Napoleon, the Kaiser, and Hitler. They had given warnings. Biden refused to close the door to possible Ukrainian NATO membership. Yes, the Russian invasion was an absolute violation of international law, of the UN Charter. That has to be condemned. But in this circumstance, we also have to, I think, be somewhat realistic. The idea that we're going to fight a long war, fought to the last Ukrainian in order to weaken Russia, is going to spell considerable pain, disaster for Ukrainians, for people in the United States, across Europe, and so on. We need to be looking at how we can encourage a negotiated resolution to this. Ideas are on the table. The sense is that we need to have probably three different layers of negotiations, one between Ukraine and Russia, facilitated by a number of countries, and including possibly the Pope as well, the Vatican as well. Secondly, U.S. and NATO negotiations with Russia toward creating strategic stability and beginning to explore what the post-war European security architecture might look like. And finally, we're going to have strategic stability negotiations and nuclear disarmament negotiations between the United States and Russia. Russia isn't going to go away. And, you know, we need to be realistic here. I mean, how many Ukrainians do we want to sacrifice? They're losing, 200 or more a day from the military, not to mention what's happening to their cities.
You know, we could go on a long time about Ukraine. And one of the interesting things about this article is making the point that it's actually probably been Europe that has suffered more from the economic sanctions the United States and NATO has imposed than Russia has. And certainly to the extent that these embargoes have contributed to the rise in price of gasoline, it very well may be, you know, what ensures the Republicans, you know, win back control of both houses of Congress. But you're there in Vienna because I guess they're having an open meeting about the issue of the non-proliferation treaty about nuclear weapons. What is this meeting designed to accomplish?
Sure. So this is called the first meeting of states parties for the Treaty on Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. That's quite a mouthful, I know. But, you know, we've had for now, over 50 years, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, one of the most important treaties of the 20th century. And in that treaty, the nuclear powers committed to engage in good faith negotiations for the complete elimination of their nuclear arsenals. As we know, the nuclear powers at this point are engaged in massive and extremely dangerous nuclear arms races. The United States committed to spending almost $2 trillion to replace its entire nuclear arsenal and its delivery systems. And the rest of the world just got disgusted with the failure of the nuclear powers to fulfill their obligations. So over a period of time, a series of conferences were held that sought to change the paradigm. Instead of focusing on the concept of deterrence and, you know, so-called national security, to focus on the humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons, which, as we know from Hiroshima and Nagasaki and from the many nuclear weapons victims from nuclear weapons tests, you know, are unacceptable. I mean, we're tactical nuclear weapons to be used by Russia in Ukraine out of desperation. It would likely escalate, you know, to a full-scale thermonuclear exchange and the end of life as we know it. So these nations, the non-nuclear weapons nations, many of them small nations, held a series of conferences and then negotiations at the United Nations in 2017, which led to the negotiation of this treaty, which basically renounces all the parties to the treaty, renounce ever becoming nuclear powers, even allowing nuclear weapons in their country.
You got 25 seconds.
Okay. And so the conference here in Vienna is designed to move to implement this treaty and to build more support, with the idea of ultimately surrounding, isolating, and leading the nuclear powers to finally fulfill their commitments to nuclear disarmament.
And honestly, the Ukraine war has raised, you know, of course, the threat of nuclear weapons use. Joe Gerson, president of the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security, your website?
CPDCS.org. Please go visit it, and we'll be in touch with you.
And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I will mention that I did put the link to this article we were discussing into the promotion on mediasanctuary.org for the stories. I think one of the interesting things, the point being made by this, you know, used to be the vice chair actually of intelligence at the CIA, is that probably or perhaps the biggest political loser in this whole fight is not going to be Russia. It's going to be the United States, because once again, Europe is beginning to realize that the United States acts like a cowboy in order to advance their own short-term political interest without really looking at the broader political picture, and it is increasing the political isolation of the United States in Europe and elsewhere.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sally Beckley.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany.
This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. Last Saturday, the Poor People's March drew tens of thousands of activists from across the country to D.C., building on the march called by Martin Luther King Jr. that took place posthumously more than a half a century ago. Organizers challenged the evils of systematic racism, poverty, the war, economy, and ecological devastation. Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry jumped on the very early morning bus to DC for the rally to cover it. Hi, welcome, Willie Terry. Can you tell us about what your day was like in DC?
Yeah. Hello, how y'all doing?
Doing good.
All right. Well, I went to the rally. We left the night of the 17th. And I caught the bus. It was about 1 a.m. and we left about 1:30 that morning. It was a cool morning. But, they said we're going to warm up. They were checking people, making sure that everybody had their COVID shot and everybody wore masks, which was good. And the bus wasn't overcrowded, which I'm glad, so we were, safe distance from each other. And we was ready to go, to D.C. and express our outrage about poverty in this country. So
Will, you went down there to interview people, obviously about the rally. Who are some of the people that you did interview that will be, hearing about on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine in the, next week or so?
Well, let me just say right up front, there was a lot of people there. And I did interview some of the people that came from some of the other states and cities. I also interviewed the co-chairperson, I think her name is Liz Theora. She's the co-chairperson to Reverend Barbara. And there was a lot of, celebrities there, but, it was kind of hard to interview them because of the crowd and because of the people that was around them. So I do have a lot of information and audio on the speakers who spoke at the podium. Like I taped Reverend Martin Luther King's daughter. She spoke, and Cornel West, and of course, Reverend Barbara.
So what was the energy in the crowd like in DC, and who was there?
Oh, the energy in the crowd, it was a lot of energy, powerful energy, I would say. People get off the bus, and we had to walk quite a way to get there because the rally was at 3rd and Pennsylvania Avenue. And as we got off the bus, we were marching, we was, saying chants and different things. And when we got there, I think about 9:30, it was a whole lot of people. I mean, it was a lot of people there already. And I think that because a lot of people, some people came in the night before, and they stayed over, which was, I wish we could have did it. I wish we could have stayed over, because it was really taxing on your physical body, going down there and coming right back.
So what were some of the speeches or even people that you met or signs that most, you know, moved you at this event?
Well, I think the major sign is that, you know, they talked about that we were going to continue this struggle and we wasn't going to go one step backwards. So that was the major theme of the whole thing, that, you know, we were going to continue until this country dealt with the question of poverty. You know, as you know, they said there's 140 million poor and low-income people in the U.S. And that's a lot of people. And that was before the pandemic. And during the pandemic, some of the billionaires have made trillions. They're trillions of dollars. But about 9 million more people have went into poverty since that time. You know, they made those billions of dollars, people were still going into poverty. And there's a lot of people who are one step away from economic ruin.
So you're the Hudson Mohawk's labor correspondent. So what was labor's role in this?
Labor did a lot of the mobilization. They did a lot of the work in terms of getting their members to come out, getting buses. Labor also provided some financial support. And they was there. They was there in bunches. Level 99, DC 37, AXME, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Worker was there. There was a lot of different trade unions there.
Now, Sally mentioned earlier there were four basic, you know, themes to the Poor People's March. And I think, you know, addressing racism and poverty is certainly things that people associated with Dr. King and, you know, the prior Poor People's March. But King, as his rally did, also talked or addressed the war economy. And perhaps a little bit more than in the past, this rally also talked about, you know, ecological devastation, environmental justice, I would assume, you know, sort of, you know, climate change, climate collapse. You know, what were some of the themes or what were some of the points you heard about the war economy and the climate at this rally?
Well, let me just say this right here. It was about six themes to this, you know, instead of four. Because you mentioned some, you know, one was the systemic racism, they raised a lot. The other one was the poverty and also the ecological devastation. And also there was denial of health care. That was one of the major things. And militarism and the expansion of the war economy. That's what they talked about. They talked a lot about, they didn't go so much into the war, but they kind of said that this country is spending, you know, $30 billion on war while probably only giving a billion or something to the, you know, the to help people in who's in dire need in terms of the poor. So they talked about the military and the expansion of the war economy. And they also talked about the false narrative of Christian nationalism. And I guess that probably, you know, would go partly to Donald Trump, what Donald Trump kind of helped create it. So those was like about the six things that they talked about and that they kind of raised at this particular march, which wasn't a march though, you know, it was like really a mass gathering. Although some people did march up and down, but the overall rally was a mass rally, just a mass gathering.
So, Willie, we want you to make sure you keep on roaming, and I guess people can go to the mediasanctuary.org website and, you know, look up stories. It'll be probably March. You're going to label them the Poor People's March so people can easily find them.
Yeah, they can go to the the poorpeoplecampaign.org website too, and they can get more information. And matter of fact, what people are doing since who came back from the rally, they're having debriefing, you know, in a lot of the cities and states. And they have one here tonight, which I couldn't make at 6:30.
Right as we speak.
Right as we speak.
I hopefully they're listening to you.
Right. Well, I'm hoping that I could get some of them to come on radio and talk about their experience. You know, so I'm going to work on that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Willie Cherry, Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Roman Labor correspondent.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Willie. Up next, Felicia Kuhn, president of the Kate Mullaney Chapter of Coalition of Labor Union Women's Capital District Branch, talks with Kathy Silber.
It's time once again for our weekly check-in with a local community organization. And today our spotlight is on the Coalition of Labor Women in the Capital District. I'm talking with the president, Felicia Kuhn. Hi, Felicia.
Hi, Kathy. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing all right. How are you?
Lovely.
So I'd like to ask you to introduce the Coalition of Labor Union, Labor Union Women, and tell us about the local chapter.
Okay, so we are the Kate Mullaney Chapter of Coalition Labor Union Women. We are actually named after an amazing woman from Troy, New York. Kate Mullaney was an Irish immigrant. She was 23 years old, a collar laundress at one of the 14 commercial laundries in Troy in the 1800s. Laundresses would often burn their hands in boiling water, starching collars. They would often work 12 to 14 hours a day. They are working women. They were working women. Their earnings a week would only be $3 to $4 a week. Imagine living on that little in such a thriving community in the 1800s.
Okay, but I got to stop. Is that $3 to $4? Well, I just need to know, is that $3 to $4 in today's dollars or $3 to $4 in 1800s dollars?
Oh, great question.
Well, anyway, let's it's not a stretch to know that they were grossly underpaid and their working conditions were tremendously unsafe.
Oh, yes. Yes. And again, this is well before the job standards of safety was in place. So in 1864, she organized 300 women and created one of the first all-women unions, the Collar Laundry Women, Collar Laundry Union. Almost 158 years ago, Kate Mullaney led them on a strike for better wages and working conditions. Her famous quote, as it worldly known, is, "Don't iron while the strike is hot."
Well put.
Yes.
And so her strike was successful, I gather.
It was. After 5 days, they won the strike and received a 25% pay increase.
Great.
That's pretty inspirational.
Very.
For women in the 1800s.
Absolutely. I mean, women couldn't even vote then. So yeah. This is really great that you've named your chapter after her. And I understand CLUW, which you guys fondly call CLU, is a national organization. And in New York, there's only four chapters, and the Capital District Kate Mullaney chapter is one of them. Is that right?
That is correct. So there is New York City, Long Island, Buffalo, and us. We are actually, a little fun fact too, we are the only chapter that is part of CLU that is named after somebody. Everybody else has named themselves their area.
Well, that's so. That explains why I had a little bit of trouble finding you guys online at first, because I kept looking up Capital District Coalition of Labor Union Women and not a lot was coming up. And then I suddenly felt, oh, this Kate Mullaney thing. Now that's the thing. So tell us about the national organization, when it was founded, why, if you know, and what are the sort of core objectives or values that the national organization exists to promote?
So the national organization was founded in the around 1974, I believe. It was in the early to mid 1970s. And the primary purpose is to unify all union women in a strong organization to determine and seek remedies to our common problems and concerns, to develop action programs within the framework of the labor movement, and to effectively promote our objectives. So we have a couple of core objectives that we like to follow. We want to empower women for the greater participation at all levels in the labor movement. We want those women to get involved. We want you as a woman to be able to have a seat at the table and to be able to voice your opinion so you can be heard. And for the leaders to reach around and help lift the younger or the more quieter women up so they can feel it too. We want to be able to organize the unorganized. We want to help develop the labor movement.
You're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
We want everybody to be in the union, to have those rights in the workplace, those job standards, fair and adequate benefits and wages. We want to also promote affirmative action, social and economic justice in the workplace. We want to be able to have we don't want to be discriminated. We don't want to have sexism come into play. We want equal opportunity. And we also want to increase participation of women in the political and legislative processes. So we want you as a woman to be able to go out and be a board member or an officer within your own union. If that's not something that you would want to do, you can go to city council, go to your school board. Shucks, you can even run for president.
Are you planning to do that anytime soon?
No.
I'll look. I mean, I'll look to join your campaign staff. So we had you, Hudson Mohawk Magazine had you on the show back in February, and you were showcasing Clue's event for International Women's Day. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yep. Back in March for International Women's Month, we had an event for International Women's Day, and our theme was breaking the bias. So we had politicians, we had a union president come in, a retired police officer, and to talk about breaking the bias and how we can overcome it, because they are great examples of having to fight those biases, whether it's another man or another woman, and how they were able to overcome it.
Thank you. I realize time is flying here. We've only got a couple minutes left. And so I understand you're in a building and growth phase, and you're taking the summer off. So the next meeting is when?
It is August 29th at 6 p.m. It is a hybrid. So a link to the Zoom can be published, or you can join us at the CWA 1118's building at 6 p.m. And that address is at 4 Wembley Court, Albany, New York.
And I will put the email in the blurb for this with the link to this interview, so that people who want to get the Zoom link or want more information about getting involved contact your Kate Mullaney chapter directly. What does it take to be a member of this chapter? Who's eligible?
Anybody who wants to be involved and who's looking to build some interest and put energy to help join forces with other local women. You don't have to be a union member to join. We just want that drive. You can be a man, you can be a woman, you can be non-binary. We'll be more than happy to take anybody with open arms so we can all learn and grow from each other and help build each other up and take action and be able to do events like what we did in March.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Cassie, for having me this lovely afternoon.
Okay, until next time.
So the Hudson Mohawk Magazine has been stepping up its coverage of various local organizing efforts for unions. I have a piece earlier this week about the effort at Capital Roots to unionize, and I believe we had some feedback on Starbucks and Amazon, and going to be out going up there for Skidmore. That was Felicia Kuhn talking, who's the president of the Kate Mullaney chapter, Coalition Labor Union Women, Capital District, talking with Kathy Silber. For more information on the national organization, you can see www.cluw.org. And their next Capital District meeting is August 29th at 6 p.m.
Meg Marone is a longtime producer with Hudson Mohawk Magazine. She has unfortunately gone missing over the last few months after going for a stay in Western Massachusetts. A local teacher, she had also been active in the area poetry scene. We continue to bring attention to her situation in our hopes that Megan will be found safe and sound. Hudson Mohawk Magazine continues to run segments featuring Megan from our archives to help bring attention to the search. Here, she speaks on behalf of the Green Sanctuary Committee of the Albany Unitarian Church about the relationship between the Extinction Rebellion and the Green New Deal at a forum at the Albany Public Library on March 9th, 2009.
The second speaker at the Green New Deal Forum at the Albany Public Library on March 9th was Meg Marone, who is with the Green Sanctuary Committee of the Albany Unitarian Church.
So the focus of my talk is going to be on the Extinction Rebellion and also the whole idea of forming a local group that supports the national and international movements of Extinction Rebellion. So I'll open with a bit of a definition, and then I think it would be helpful to talk about how the Green New Deal overlaps at a macro level with the national and local Green New Deal, and then also where it diverges from the Green New Deal for sure. Some of the slides will have quotes from the Extinction Rebellion website. So the purpose of the group is that it's to grow capacity to face the reality of the ecological and social crisis with love as our principle, guided by reason and conscience. And I worked with a lot of friends from Troy in preparing this presentation, and that we decided to also definitely communicate to you that the Extinction Rebellion founders in Europe have a very strong sense that they want the movement to have an emotional core to it. So at the foundational level, there's an articulation of the Extinction Rebellion of grief, and the whole idea that given all of the statistics that Howie mentioned within his speech, that it's appropriate to feel grief over the situation, the existential conundrum that all of us find ourselves in together. And that actually we can move forward in a more honest, driven, and empowered way if we're honest about the grief of the current situation. A few of the people who were foundational in Great Britain to the coming together of people. The first person is Roger Hallam, and he is an organic farmer, and he's been farming for 20 years. And his PhD is from King's College, and he teaches about effective radical campaign design. Then there's Gail Bradbrook, and she's an economic justice campaigner. Her PhD is in molecular biophysics, influential in one of the major Extinction Rebellion actions, which was to block all of the major passageways into London in November of 2018. Another huge figure within 18-year-old climate activist who skipped school in order to sit in front of the Swedish parliament to speak her piece. So let's definitely try to hear from Greta and gave a speech basically calling out the corporate and governmental interests that Howie once again mentioned in his speech, the whole idea that the entire corporate state is complicit within the problem that we face that we're facing. So those are the main figures that were foundational to the forming of Extinction Rebellion. And they have four major, by they, we're talking about documents that are coming from Great Britain. There are four major demands that Extinction Rebellion is calling for, that governments need to tell the truth about the climate emergency and work alongside media to communicate this to citizens, that the government needs to work to legally binding policies to reduce emissions to net zero by 2025, which even 2025, a lot of people see as being a very, you know, that still could be an extremely dangerous position for us. But in the phrasing, you'll notice that it says legally binding, and this would be the point of divergence right now for the state of the Green New Deal, because obviously there's just an incredible amount of controversy over even getting the Green New Deal passed as a resolution, let alone getting it to the point of being a law with consequence. And I think for people to really feel hope in the fact that there could be some sort of change, or at the very least action, in the face of this situation, there has to be consequence for the entities that have caused the situation. Right now, even with the Green New Deal resolution, there's no consequence for any corporation that still uses fossil fuels. There's also a call for the establishment of a National People's Congress to oversee changes as part of creating a democracy fit for purpose, a just transition that prioritizes the most vulnerable people. So the idea that built into this movement is the idea that the most vulnerable, the power structures should be tipped on their heads. Indigenous sovereignty should be a main concern. Reparations and remediation led by and for Black people, Indigenous people, people of color, poor communities. These are all built into the foundational documents. It's also like Gail Hasbrook and Roger Hallam, they were all involved in Occupy as well. But the fact that there is this rhetoric right from the incipients of this group is actually an important movement ahead from even the Occupy movement, which was addressing an intersectionality of economic human rights issues and the environment. There's also the idea of establishing legal rights for ecosystems to thrive and regenerate in perpetuity, repairs of ongoing ecocide, and the idea of trying to maintain a living planet for all. So in terms of how to get this done, there's the call for nonviolent direct action. And right now, the foundational documents and the website encourage people to congregate in the major cities. So the whole idea that I formed a Google group for Extinction Rebellion Capital Region, but the whole idea that our purpose in the Capital Region would be to maintain community support for each other and also to be preparing to take action with the big national events within cities. So the April 15th is the first major national and international Extinction Rebellion Day, and the whole idea that people would go to New York from the Capital Region and support where the real power base is within major American and international cities. So here's where, that's an image I don't have time to show you of people shutting down the five major bridges in London in November of 2018. But just again to emphasize that if you would like to join Extinction Rebellion, which the Green Sanctuary Committee of the Unitarian Church is 50 people, and they've signed up to join with Extinction Rebellion. The whole idea that the focus is on grief and communication and forming community in terms of true vulnerability, getting people to communicate about both joy and sorrow as we figure out how we're going to push ahead in terms of approaching the crisis. And that whole idea is also about regenerative culture, a culture that isn't about denial, ignoring these problems, consumerism, but creating a culture and a community of people who can actually trust each other and communicate with each other, and art and music all coming about because of that.
So that was Meg Marone from a couple of years ago talking at a forum on the Green New Deal about the particular role that the Extinction Rebellion might play. The Extinction Rebellion, particularly in the Capital District, seems to be one of the climate advocacy groups that's been most, harmed by the coronavirus, because they rely so much on civil disobedience. And those type of protests are more difficult to pull off during the coronavirus. I know they actually had a workshop earlier this week with Capital District Solidarity Labor Committee to try to, try to get labor more involved. So you can check out Extinction Rebellion. Now, Meg Marone, who, has been a longtime community news producer here at the Media Sanctuary, a local teacher, a poet. She has been unfortunately missing since March 27th. Apparently, she went hiking in Lee, Massachusetts after checking into an area hotel. Her car was found a day or so later at Long Cope Park. People continue to try to draw attention, to her situation. You can go to find Megan Marone. .com if you want to get more information, or the most updated information. Not much, to be honest, has been updated in recent weeks, unfortunately. You can go to mediasanctuary.org, type in Meg Marone, MAROHN, in our stories, and find a lot of stories that Meg has contributed over the years. A very loved and respected community member here at the Sanctuary, and we certainly wish her and her family, the best of luck, and look forward to hopefully seeing her in the future.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sally Becker.
And our Mark Dunley. Our engineer tonight is the patient Kaylin McPherson. Our content is produced almost entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, you can email us at mediasanctuary.org. Thank you to Willie Terry, a Roman Labor correspondent, for his contribution, Kathy Silber, and Meg Marone for the segments that she contributed. Thank you to all our volunteers and Sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a Sanctuary sustainer. I'm one. And you can go to mediasanctuary.org.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news, or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Hudson Mohawk Magazine is also available on demand as a podcast or as individual stories at mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.